You're listening to the Berkshire Hathaway Annual Shareholders Meeting Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Yahoo Finance.
All right, here's a question from Lou Bogart in Boca Raton, Florida. He says, I'm a longtime shareholder with a concern as I head into retirement. I understand the theory that splitting shares does nothing for the value of shares. However, with the extremely high price on A shares, when I wish to draw down some money on my portfolio in retirement, I'm facing a large tax hit. Say the average price has been about $300,000 this year, and I'm sitting on a $200,000 capital gains liability for each share. If I need $60,000 in additional cash during my retirement, I need to sell a full share and get hit with $200,000 tax liability. If you would split the stock 10 for 1, I could sell two $30,000 shares and keep my tax liability at a more manageable $40,000. I could also maintain more of my investment in Berkshire. He said, have you thought about this? In retrospect, I should have bought B shares, but didn't think of that at the time.
You can convert A to B shares, which is exactly what takes place when I give away the money in July to the five foundations. I actually convert it immediately before the gift. I mean, and so they get B shares. And the truth is the B shares are very useful to people that want to either give away a small portion of what they have or spend it or whatever it may be. So you can convert the A to B shares, which is exactly what I've been doing now for 14 years as I give it away, and solve that problem. And we split the B shares, as I remember it, at one point, you know, just to make it even more manageable so that people could deal with smaller denominations. The B shares, the A shares have a different voting power, but we passed some resolution some time ago, I think, and it certainly would be the case in any event. We're never going to give the A shares an advantage over the B. They used to have an advantage in a shareholder-designated contribution program that we had, and we put that in there when we started, but that's that goes way back in time, and that doesn't exist anymore, so that the B and the A are going to get treated exactly the same over time. It's true the A have more votes, but they sell very close to parity all the time. So I would say that if you want to do anything in terms of raising cash and you've got a lot of A shares, you know, you take one or two shares of A, and plenty of people I know have done this, and just cash it in and turn it into B and give yourself whatever amount of cash you want to get.
This is one that comes from Thomas Lin in Taiwan. He says, Warren once said that banking is a good business if you don't do dumb things on the asset side. Given that the pandemic might put a lot of pressure on the loans, dumb things that got done in the past few years are likely to explode. Through reading annual reports, 10-Qs, and other public information, what clues are you looking for to decide whether a bank is run by a true banker who avoids doing dumb things?
That's a very good question, but I would say that the one thing that made Chairman Powell's a job a little easier this time than it was in 2008-09 is that the banks are in far better shape. So in terms of thinking about what was good for the economy, he wasn't at the same time worrying about what he was going to do with Bank A or Bank B to merge them with somebody else or put added strains on the system or anything. And the banks were very involved with the problem in 2008 and 2009. They had done some things they shouldn't have done in some of them, and they were certainly in far different financial condition now. So that the banking system is not the problem in this particular show. I mean, the government is. We decided as a people to shut down part of the economy in a big way. And it was not the fault of anyone that it happened. Things do happen in this world. Earthquakes happen. You know, huge hurricanes happen. This was something different. But the banks... The banks need regulation. I mean, you know, they benefit from the FDIC, but part of having the government standing behind your deposits is to behave well, and I think that the banks have behaved very well, and I think they're in very good shape. I mean, that's why the FDIC has built up $100 billion that I've talked about. I mean, that they've assessed the banks in recent years at accelerated amounts in certain periods, and they even differentiated against the big banks. So they built up great reserves there, and they built their own balance sheets, and they are not presently part of Chairman Powell's problem, whereas they were very much part of Chairman Bernanke's problem back in 2008 and 9. How you spot the people that are doing the dumb things is not easy because, well, sometimes it's easy, I don't see a lot that bothers me, but banks are, in the end, institutions that operate with significant amounts of other people's money. And if problems become severe enough in an economy, even strong banks can be under a lot of stress, and we'll be very glad we've got the Federal Reserve System standing behind them. I don't see special problems in the banking industry now. I could think of possibilities, and Jamie Dimon referred to this a little bit in the JP Morgan report. You can dream of scenarios that puts a lot of strain on banks, and they're not totally impossible, and that's why we have a Fed. And I think that, overall the banking system is not going to be the problem. But I'm not I wouldn't say that with 100% certainty, because there are certain possibilities that exist in this world where banks could have problems. They're going to have problems with energy loans. They're going to have problems, they're going to have extra problems with consumer credit. They're going to have, but they know it, and they're well reserved. Well, they're well capitalized for it. They were reserve building in the first quarter, and they may need to build more reserves, but they are not a primary worry of mine at all. We own a lot of banks, or we own a lot of bank stocks. Greg, do you have any thoughts on it?
No, I really, you touched on it earlier too, just in general, which is we don't know how long this pandemic will go. We don't know if there's going to be a second event, which are just risks that are really unknown at this time. And the banks will have to continue to manage through that as the businesses do. But you've already highlighted that, obviously.
Yeah. Becky.
All right. This question, I was looking for one of these because I got several questions that came in similar to this. I was looking for one of these a moment ago. This one's from Andrew Wenke. He says, can you ask Warren why he didn't repurchase Berkshire shares in March when they dropped to a price that was 30% lower than the price that he had repurchased shares for in January and February?
Yeah, it was very, very, very short period where they were 30% less. I don't think Berkshire shares relative to present value are at a significantly different discount than they were when we were paying somewhat higher prices. I mean, it's like Kane said, or whoever it was, if the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? We always think about it, but I don't feel that it's far more compelling to buy Berkshire shares now than I would have felt 3 months or 6 months or 9 months ago. It's always a possibility, and we'll see what happens. Greg, you think about repurchasing shares?
I mean, generally.
No, I think our approach, Warren's the right approach. I mean, you're always, I can't really add anything other than the approach is the right approach. We approach it when we see it's the right thing for our shareholders to be repurchasing, and that doesn't mean we're repurchasing all the time or the view doesn't change.
Well, there could be a price relative to value at the time, not relative to what it was worth a year ago. I mean, the value of certain things have decreased. Our airline position was a mistake. Berkshire is worth less today because I took that position than if I hadn't. And there are other decisions like that. And they're not, you know, it is not more compelling to buy the shares now than it was when we were buying them. It's not less compelling. I mean, it's a wash, but we didn't do anything. The price has not gotten to a level or not been at a level where it really feels way better to us than other things, including the option value of money, to step up in a big, big way.
This question comes from three investors in Israel, Lidar Zluf, Yossi Zluf, and Dan Gorfung. They want to know about the credit card industry. It says, how do you explain the rise in the average credit card interest rate in recent years compared to the federal funds rate? What are the forces that you think might keep it at or around current levels, and what are the forces that might drive it lower in the future?
Well, that is not a subject that I'm, you know, obviously it affects American Express to some degree. It affects the banks we own, but interest rates on credit cards respond to competition, obviously, to loss potential, which obviously has gone up significantly in the last few months, although it's gone down perhaps from some other periods you can pick in the past. But I don't really have much I can bring to the party on that question. We are not in the... Well, that isn't true. Our furniture companies, a couple of them have their own credit card, although they do a lot of business on other people's credit cards. My general advice to people, I mean, you know, we have an interest in credit cards, but people, I think people should avoid using credit cards as a piggy bank to be raided. I had a woman come to see me here not long ago, and she'd come on some money, and not very much, but it was a lot to her. And she's a friend of mine, and she said, "What should I do with it?" You know, and I said, "Well, what do you want on your credit card?" And she said, "Well, I owe X," and I said, "Well, what you should do? I don't know what interest rate she was paying, but I think, you know, I think I asked her and she knew, and it was something like 18% or something." I said, "I don't know how to make 18%. You know, I mean, if I owed any money at 18%, the first thing I'd do with any money I had would be to pay it off. It's going to be way better than any investment idea I've got." And that wasn't what she wanted to hear. And then later on in the conversation, she talked about her daughter. And her daughter had $1,000 or $2,000 or something. And she said, "Well, what should I do with?" And she named the girls money. And I said, "Have her lend it to you. You know, and I mean, if you're willing to pay 18% or whatever, I mean, she's not going to find a better deal. I'll lend you money." It just doesn't make sense. You can't go through life, you know, borrowing money at those rates and be better off. The thing, so I encourage everybody. It's contrary to my own or Berkshire's interests in certain cases, but and the world is in love with credit cards. But I would suggest to anybody that the first thing they do in life is not on. You know, they can get to something else later on, but. Don't be paying even 12% to anybody. I mean, it's pay that off, and if they're really a good credit and they don't want to do it, come and see me personally. I'll lend you the money at that rate. Greg, what do you tell your children?
No, same advice. Excellent advice. No, I have three that. Carefully use their credit card, more I would say for not the obviously people use it a lot more as they go into the digital world and e-commerce world, but then the goal has to be to repay it. It doesn't mean you because you have to use it for those type of transactions, you run up the balance, but there's an incremental risk there now.
It's a matter of convenience for some people, but I would have trouble if I were paying 12% for money or whatever it might be, it would not be a good thing. You won't see Berkshire paying that.
Warren, this question is from Lindsay Schumacher. Do you have something you were saying?
We probably ought to wind this up maybe in 15 minutes. Can you select the best ones?
Okay, absolutely. Yeah, well, I've got a couple more questions for you. This one's from Lindsay Schumacher. She says, Warren, what's your opinion regarding the payroll protection plan?
Well, I don't want to get into politics generally, but I think that's a very good idea to take care of the people that are having terrible trouble taking care of themselves in a period like this. I mean, if the government and surrounding conditions and whatever it may be, if you're telling a lot of businesses essentially, you know, quit doing business for a long time, and it's one thing to tell me, but to tell somebody that's living from paycheck to paycheck that way, you know, I'm all for it. It must be hell to administer. I mean, any huge program. I don't want to. I'll never get into criticizing on how people do this or that because I've had problems myself in running a few big things. It just isn't that easy to inaugurate incredibly large problems. There's going to be a certain amount of fraud. There's going to be everything doesn't go perfectly, but I am 100% for taking care of the people that really get hurt by something that they've got nothing to do with, and where it's, you know, who knows how long it lasts. It's, you've got millions and millions of people that are worrying about something that they weren't worried about a few months ago, and they didn't do anything. They showed up for work on time, and they pleased the people they dealt with, and whatever it may have been. And now they don't have a job, or they've been furloughed or whatever. So I'm totally for the basic idea, and I think it's very difficult. You can't carry it out perfectly. You do your best, and you do it promptly. And I give real credit, you know, to both Congress for acting promptly on what the problem is. They've sort of caught on from what they learned in 2008 and 2009, I think. And I give credit to trying to do what I think is very much the right thing, and I don't sit around and think about how I could do it better. Greg?
No, I agree with the comments.
Warren, this question comes from Bill Murray, the actor, who's also a shareholder in Berkshire. He says, this pandemic will graduate a new class of war veterans. Healthcare, food supply, deliveries, community services. So many owe so much to these few. How might this great country take our turn and care for all of them?
Well, we won't be able to pay, actually. You know, it's like people that landed in Normandy or something. I mean, the poor, the disadvantaged, they suffer. There's an unimaginable suffering, and at the same time, they're doing all these things that working 24-hour days, and we don't even know their names. So we ought to do if we go overboard on something, we ought to do things that can help those people. And this country, I've said it a lot of times before, but the history of it, I mean, we are a rich, rich, rich country. And the people that are doing the kind of work that Bill talks about, they're contributing a whole lot more than some of the people that came out of the right womb, you know, or got lucky and things, or know how to arbitrage bonds or whatever it may be. And I'm, you know, in a large part, I'm one of those guys. So you really try to create a society that, under normal conditions, with more than $60,000 of GDP per capita, that anybody that works 40 hours a week can have a decent life without a second job and with a couple of kids and have, you know, they can't live like kings. I don't mean that, but that nobody should be left behind. It's like a rich family. You know, you find rich families, and if they have five heirs or six heirs, you know, they try and pick maybe the most able one to run the business, but they don't. They don't forget about, you know, the kid that actually may be a better citizen in some ways even than the one that does the best at business. But it just doesn't happen to have market value skills. So I do not think that a very rich company ought to totally abide by what the market dishes out, you know, in 18th century style or something of the sort. So I welcome ideas that go in that direction. We've gone in that direction. You know, we did come up with Social Security in the 30s. We've made some progress, but we ought to. I mean, we have become very, very, very rich as a country, and things have improved for the bottom 20%. I mean, you can see various statistics on that, but I'd rather be in the bottom 20% now than be in the bottom 20% 100 years ago or 50 years ago. But it's what's really improved is the top 1%. And I hope we as a country move in a direction where people Bill's talking about get treated better, and it isn't going to hurt. It isn't going to hurt the country's growth and it's overdue, but a lot of things are overdue. I will still say we're a better society than we were 100 years ago. But you would think with our prosperity, we would hold ourselves to even higher standards of taking care of our fellow man, particularly when you see a situation like you've got today, where it's the people whose names you don't know that are watching the people come in and watching the bodies go out. Greg?
Yeah, the only other group that I would highlight, I think it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out, is with the number of homeschooling and the children that are home. I think there's we've always had so much respect for our teachers, but we all talk about how we don't take care of them. And you know, it is remarkable to hear how many people comment that clearly we don't recognize, or, you know, I have a little 8-year-old Beckett at home, and, you know, plenty of challenges for mom, but all of a sudden you respect the institution, the school, the teachers, and everything around it. So then when I think of our companies and the delivery employees we have, it's absolutely amazing what they're doing, and they're truly on the front line. You know, that's where we have our challenges around keeping them health and safety. And then you go all the way to the rail. The best videos you see out of our companies are when we have folks that are actively engaged in moving supplies, food, medical products, and they're so proud of it, and they recognize they're making a difference. So a lot of it is we just owe them a great thanks. And, you know, Warren, you touched on it. We can some way, maybe hopefully longer term, compensate them, but there's a great deal of thanks, and I probably just think an immense amount new appreciation for a variety of folks.
We're going the right direction all around the country, but it's been awfully slow.
Gentlemen, I'll make this the last question. It comes from Phil King. He says, many people in the press and politics are questioning the validity of capitalism. What can you say to them that might prompt them to take a look at capitalism more favorably?
Well, the market system works wonders, and it's also brutal if left entirely to itself. And we wouldn't be the country we are if the market system hadn't been allowed to function. And to some extent, you can say that other countries around the world that have improved their way of life dramatically, to some extent, have copied us. So the market system is marvelous in many respects, but it needs government. And it is creative destruction, but for the ones who are destroyed, it can be a very brutal game, and for the people who work in the industries and all of that sort of thing. So I do not want to come up with anything different than capitalism, but I certainly do not want unfettered capitalism. I don't think we'll move away from it, but I think we capitalists, I'm one of them, you know, I think there's a lot of thought that should be given to what would happen if we all drew straws again for particular market-based skills. Somewhere way back, somebody invented television. I don't know who it was. And then they invented cable. Then they invented pay systems and all of that. And so a fellow that could bat 406 in 1941 was worth $20,000 a year. And now a marginal big leaguer, you know, will make vastly greater sums because, in effect, the stadium size was increased from 30 or 40 or 50,000 people to the country. And the market system, capitalism, took over. And it's very uneven. And incidentally, I think that Ted Williams is worth a whole lot more money than I've ever should make. But the market system can work toward a winner-takes-all type situation, and we don't want to discourage people from working hard and thinking hard. But that alone doesn't do it. There is a lot of randomness in the capitalist system, including inherited wealth. And I think we can keep the best parts of a market system and capitalism, and we can do a better job of making sure that everybody participates in the prosperity that produces. Greg?
Yeah. No, I think it's always keeping the best parts of it. And I even think if we look at the current environment we're in, i.e. in the pandemic, and we have to do it only when we can do it properly and reemerge. But in some ways, the best opportunity for people is when we're back working, clearly, and that the system's functioning again. But that's the obvious. And then there's, as Warren, you've highlighted, there's a lot of imperfections, but it's still it's definitely the best model out there that just needs some fine tuning.
And Becky, at the end, I would just
slip in one more quick
Absolutely.
Question? I forgot this one. Someone sent it in earlier. Thanks. Anderson Haxton wrote in. He said, Warren mentioned that Ben Graham is one of the three smartest people he's ever met. I'd like to ask him the names of the other two.
Well, I may not be one of the smartest, but I'm smart enough not to name the other two. I'd make two people happy. But I would, it isn't a, Ben Graham is one of the three smartest people. And I've known some really smart people. Smartness is not necessarily does not necessarily equate to wisdom either. And Ben Graham, one of the things he said he liked to do every day was he wanted to do something creative, something generous, and something foolish. And he said he was pretty good at the latter. But he was pretty good. He was amazing, actually, at the creative. But it's interesting that IQ does not always translate into rationality and behavioral success or wisdom. And so I know some people that are extraordinarily wise that would not be in the top three on an IQ test. But if I wanted their judgment on some matter, even if I want to put them in a position of responsibility someplace, I might prefer them to, we'll say one of the three. That'll leave the other two feeling fine of the three. Greg, do you have any thoughts on that?
Nope. I agree with the person you named.
Yeah. There's... And Becky, I would just say again that we may have, I hope we don't, but we may get some unpleasant surprises. And we're dealing with a virus that spreads its wings in a certain way, you know, in very unpredictable ways. And how Americans react to it, there's all kinds of possibilities, but I definitely come to the conclusion after weighing all that sort of stuff, never bet against America. So thanks.
Thanks for listening to this section of the Berkshire Hathaway's annual Shareholders Meeting podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts.